From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made a number of years ago outside Los Angeles. Dr. Ken Murray tells the story of his friend Charlie, a highly respected orthopedist. Well, Charlie went to his own doctor about stomach pain, and they found a lump. It was diagnosed as pancreatic cancer. But Charlie appeared to be in luck. His doctor was considered one of the finest surgeons in the country and had developed a new procedure. That procedure had the potential to triple a patient's odds of surviving 5 years, from 5% of patients to 15% of patients. The caveat was that if it worked and Charlie lived those 5 more years, his quality of life could be poor. Charlie was 68 years old, and he quickly decided against having that procedure. He knew he would die in less than a year. He concluded that long-shot treatments with poor quality of life was not for him, and so he went home. As Dr. Murray tells it in the Wall Street Journal, Charlie never set foot in a hospital again. Instead, he focused on his family, had as much fun as he could, watched some sports, traveled a bit. He received no chemo, no radiation, no surgery. He died several months later, at home, surrounded by family. His total medical bill was less than $100. Just about every human being offers roughly the same answer when they're asked, "How do you want to die?" Most of us say, "Peacefully, painlessly, at home, preferably while sleeping." And yet when the end of life approaches, many of us fight to prolong life for ourselves or for our loved ones, even if it means dying in a hospital, hooked up to machines, with quality of life compromised. These are not easy questions, but this hour we examine that question of how to die, and we're asking why doctors die differently. My guest for the hour, Dr. Tim Quill, is the director of the Palliative Care Program at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Quill, thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
Emily Langfitt is a nurse on Strong's Sussman Palliative Care Inpatient Unit. Emily, thank you for being here.
Glad to do it.
And Laura Hogan is here, a nurse practitioner. Laura, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Quill, you've written about end of life for a number of years. You've spoken about this. Why do doctors die differently in general?
Well, I think probably because we're chickens at heart, or I'm not sure exactly what it is. I think probably we know too much about the dark side of medical treatment, particularly long-shot medical treatment. I think most doctors would take highly effective treatment, but when you start getting into longer and longer shot treatment, I think we see a lot of folks who are pretty struggling with suffering as a side effects of treatment. And again, if you thought it was going to work, highly likely you'd probably try it. But the more the odds go down, the more I think we would tend to avoid that.
Let me ask the panel, is it myth or is it reality that some doctors have walked around with either a little plaque or a medallion or a paper in their pocket that says no code, no resuscitation? Have you ever heard of that? Is that
Certainly that's something we've heard. A lot of times people talk about having it tattooed on their chest. I'm not sure how accurate it is.
I think we talk big, but when, it's easy to talk big until you're really faced with these things. When you're faced with it, it's a whole other kettle of fish, and I think most everybody who goes through this experiences that.
Well, and interestingly, in surveys, we routinely see the general public very split from what doctors and medical staffs want when it comes to the question of intervention. So the question is, if you're incapacitated, needing serious medical intervention, would you want the following? And the list includes major surgery, CPR, mechanical ventilation, kidney dialysis, a feeding tube, IV hydration, and pain medication. In a recent survey, nearly 90% of the general public said yes to all of those things. But when doctors are asked the same question, most said no. 90% of doctors say no to CPR. Nearly 90% said no dialysis, no ventilation. 80% said no to major surgery or invasive testing. Nearly 80% don't want a feeding tube. Even 60% of doctors and medical staffs don't want IV hydration. When it comes to pain medication, more than 80% of doctors and medical staff said yes. Why the gap, and I'll start with Dr. Quill, on what a doctor would want when it comes to pain medication versus the rest of these interventions?
Well, I think, again, the question you're posed has to do with if we can't speak for ourselves.
Yes.
So if we can speak for ourselves, we can make a game-time decision. But certainly for me personally, if I can't speak for myself, I want comfort measures only for everything. I want absolutely nothing that's life-prolonging. I want to be just kept comfortable. And I'm extremely strong about that. Anybody who knows me knows that I've done all the documents to make sure that that occurs. Because for me, a central part of quality of life is being able to make my own decisions. So if I can't do that anymore, then really hospice and comfort care would be what I'd want.
But so often the American public here's incapacitation, but there's this hope of revival. And you hear once in a while, you hear these stories of someone, for lack of a better term, coming out of it. And I know they're few and far between, and they hit the headlines. And so this, the American public may be, are we poorly educated about that?
I think Hollywood has framed a lot of our expectations there. If I get to judge by my, I have teenagers and all of their friends and all of the in and out of my household, they believe what they see on TV. And only since I have been working in hospice do they start to compare that with reality.
Yeah, speaking of exactly that point, CPR is such an interesting case, and I don't mean to make a case against CPR by any means here, but it was CPR on television was studied. It was studied in terms of the big popular shows, the CSIs and the medical dramas. And what they found was that 75% of television drama CPR patients survived, and most of them popped right up, stood up, and said, thank you for saving my life, and walked away. In reality, 3% are able to live sort of, for lack of a better term, normally. Another 2% live but with some complicated life challenges. Another 3% live but are what I think, for lack of a better term, vegetatively. And then 92% die. There's no way I would have known that without looking that up. Dr. Quill, are we poorly educated about CPR?
Yes, we are very optimistic about CPR. You know, CPR is in the margins, actually, because you take a look at those statistics, and those are for all comers. But when you take a look at really seriously ill populations, then those statistics would be very optimistic. So the odds, if you're really seriously ill, with other than pure cardiac disease, it works to some degree with pure cardiac disease. But if you have other diseases, many other diseases, the odds of leaving the hospital after getting CPR are almost zero.
Is there anyone on this panel, if you're incapacitated and can't speak for yourself, would you want CPR?
No, thanks.
No, thank you.
Dr. Quill?
No way, no.
No CPR?
Definitely not.
I don't want to
if I was incapacitated,
ribs breaking.
Yeah.
No I think way. If it's a permanent incapacitation, that there's no hope for recovery, going through that would not benefit me personally with my values of what I would consider quality of life.
But I think that this may shock people to hear doctors and nurses saying no to CPR. And I, again, I don't mean to denigrate CPR, but maybe it is Hollywood that's changed our expectations for what's possible. And Emily mentioned ribs breaking. That's also very common in CPR, isn't it?
Especially as people are older with more frail skeletons.
But let me also ask, before we get to your phone calls, and we've got so much to talk about as we talk about the way we die. Let me also ask for the people who say, okay, CPR, especially in non-cardiac scenarios, has a very low success rate. But it's a non-zero success rate. And if it's my husband or my wife or my father or my mother or my son or my daughter, if it's 1 in 1,000, do it. Some people will say that. And Dr. Quill, what do you say to that?
First of all, it's about what the patient would want. So the right question is, would the patient? But we take care of a lot of people who, if there is a 1 in 1,000 chance, they'd want it. That's fine. I'm glad to try to do CPR, even if it's not likely to work, if that's what a person would want. And in point of fact, right now, I'm a pretty healthy guy. I'm getting old. But if I have cardiac arrest right now, I'd want CPR. So again, I'm not opposed to CPR, but as you get sicker, the odds go from really slim to almost zero, and it's a very harsh procedure. So in that sense, it makes much less sense as you get more seriously ill.
Anyone on this panel, if you're incapacitated, would you want a feeding tube?
No, thanks.
No?
I think it depends, again, on the situation. I mean, my advanced directive outlines my things in my life that are of value to me. And so if those values are going to be gone, those activities, and I'm going to be incapacitated and need artificial feeding, it says not to do that.
Dr. Quill?
Yeah, if for me, capacity to make decisions is a core piece of quality of life. If that is gone, I definitely don't want a feeding tube.
Kidney dialysis?
Nothing. Nothing that's life-prolonging under those circumstances. Comfort measures only. Which is what hospice provides. Hospice was designed for those circumstances, and that's the best approach, in my opinion, unless somebody would like any treatment that might possibly prolong any kind of life at all costs, that's fine. Then we'll do all those other things. But that's actually a little bit exceptional under those harsh circumstances.
Next week, we're going to be hearing from Dr. David Koronis, who is talking about childhood cancer. And he, in that interview you're going to hear next week, talks about the fact that in this country, there's maybe a bit of a public misunderstanding on the word palliative, that sometimes people hear it and they think it is only associated with end of life, when it's actually associated with just alleviation of comfort. My understanding is it's creating more comfort. Can our panels, before we get to the phones, palliative care and the word palliative, misunderstood?
Yes, definitely. Many people think that this is synonymous with hospice. When we explain this to patients, we say we do a lot of different things at any stage of an illness, particularly pain and symptom management, but also helping patients understand where they're at with their disease and what the options for treatments are and help them think through those hard decisions.
Dr. Quill, palliative?
Yeah, I think that's got the essence. It's pain and symptom management, but even just as important, so that if people feel better, they can maybe take more treatment, but also really help people understand what the choices are. Medicine is so complex, and having people sit down with them and really in an unbiased way help them understand what the choices are, what the situations are they're facing is, I think, at the core of what we do, and it's really important to do. Used to be done by GPs and others. It still is to some degree, but it's really needed to have somebody to provide an unbiased view about what people are facing, and then they can make an informed decision, which is what we're all about.
We're talking about the way we die with a panel who is helping us understand all of the issues that will face all of us eventually. Dr. Tim Quill is the director of the Palliative Care Program at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Emily Langford is a nurse on Strong's Sussman Palliative Care Inpatient Unit. Laura Hogan is a nurse practitioner. And we'll get to your calls coming up here, because there's a lot of different ways we could go with this. But we mentioned that Americans, anybody really wants to, if you want to die at home. I guess nobody wants to die, but if you're going to die, most people want to die at home. But from what I'm reading, fewer of us are dying at home in 2014 than in 1950. Is that accurate?
Yes, definitely accurate.
Is that simply because we have more sort of long shot medical options that may be in play that would require people to be in a hospital?
It's complex. People are living longer. We are living longer with a lot more chronic disease. So by the time you're faced with these things, most people have got a lot of disease. They have a lot of needs for medical care and support. So people aren't dying quickly as they were in the past. It's a little easier to die at home if there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to it. In modern era, it's a long process. There's a lot of choices involved. There's a lot of care that's needed, and a lot of families are not able to do that. We're pretty spread out now. There's not a concentration of caregivers available in many families.
We're not here to put a price on anything, let alone human life, but I'm reading that in 2011, Medicare spending reached close to $554 billion. Of that $554 billion, Medicare spent 28%, about $170 billion, on just the last few months of patients' lives. So is that somewhat accurate, or do we disproportionately spend on medicine and medical care toward that end of life?
That's very accurate, yes.
Absolutely.
That's when people are the sickest.
But at the same time, we're hearing, you know, stories of those who choose not to go with a lot of these interventions, and that's not to say that pain medication doesn't have its cost, et cetera, but these long-shot interventions can certainly be more expensive. Is that also accurate?
I think the high-intensity medical care and ICUs certainly is a more costly adventure.
One of the reasons why palliative care is a good investment as a social program is because as folks get into these high-intensity, very more improbable treatments, you really want to be sure they're fully informed about what they're getting into. So again, if people want them, we're still glad to help them get it and advocate for them, but they really need to know what they're getting into, because this is high burden, high cost, low probability of long-term success treatment. Again, if that's what folks want, that's okay, but you ought to go into that with their eyes open.
And let me give you an example of that from an unlikely source. First of all, for the doctor and our nurses in the room, do you know many colleagues who have advanced directives that say try anything to preserve my life, you know, essentially say, I do want all interventions? Do you know many?
I know a few doctors who have not done their advanced directives, but I don't know any who have done them that say that.
I've also seen a few advanced directives where they say, if I have this problem, then give me this medicine and do it this way, in very specific things. But I haven't seen any that say do everything.
Dr. Quill?
Not in doctors. I have had patients who we've had we have these discussions with our patients to say, maybe you want to do an advanced directive in case you can't speak for yourself. And if that's the philosophy that they want, I encourage them to put it in their advanced directive, because we ought to be trying to keep their voice alive in this process. That's the whole purpose of an advanced directive. And if that voice is telling, if that's what it's telling, then we have to deal with it.
Okay, and we're going to spend a lot of the second half of this program on advanced directives, what you ought to know about that, how to do it, et cetera. But let me tell you the story of Dr. Peter Bach. His story, he told it himself in New York Magazine with a heartbreaking piece this summer. And his concern is that doctors might need to learn a little more effectively how to speak honestly, bluntly, with patients. He's not saying doctors are not honest. He's saying that we're all human beings, and it can be difficult to tell somebody in sort of blunt terms about chances. And Dr. Bach is a cancer doctor, essentially, in his practice, but his 47-year-old wife was diagnosed with terminal breast cancer. And he admits he went from being a doctor to being a husband, and his feeling changed. He was sitting next to her on the couch as they got the scans, and he could see instantly the cancer had spread. He essentially lied to her right there about what he knew that he was seeing, and then about her chances for survival. Then he found himself pushing for the most extreme measures when he says if it were himself, he wouldn't want those measures, and if it were his patient, he would advise against it if asked. And I want to read from his story. Quote, "Her cancer was still consuming her, of course, but I had hoped that what seemed a deadly complication was instead somehow a manageable one. She could have a shunt put in, a meter-long silicone tube that goes into the abdominal cavity, then is tunneled up under the skin, over the collarbone, then back into the circulatory system above the heart. It's a serious procedure with serious risks, including bleeding or a tear in the intestine, either of which can lead to emergency surgery. I knew of this risk and many others, but from that moment, I wanted that shunt and nearly insisted it be put in." What does Dr. Bach's story tell us, Dr. Quill?
That it's not good to have a family member be your doctor or your nurse, for that matter. But, you know, sometimes we do it because other people aren't going to step up. But if you have a doctor as a spouse or a doctor as a patient, the real challenge is to treat them like we treat any other patient, any other family, because you need that dialogue between somebody who is a little bit less biased, a little bit less emotionally involved, and who can really help sort through. And the notion he would make these decisions without informing her, you know, it sort of violates some really basic principles. Again, she might have chosen the same thing. You don't really know. But she ought to have had a voice in that process, and it ought to have been based on understanding what her disease is.
Well, I think he actually would agree with that. And I think he wanted to write that piece because he wanted to be honest about the difficult conversations and the emotions that come into it. And Dr. Peter Bach spoke to, I should say, his wife Ruth died in just about 8 months, despite all of the interventions, and they certainly did a lot. Dr. Bach spoke to the NPR affiliate in New York City and explained that he thinks many patients demand these low success measures just as he did, because, now look, he was a doctor who had a lot of knowledge about what could work, but he thinks doctors maybe you're not blunt enough at times. Let's listen to some of what Dr. Bach said to the NPR affiliate in New York City.
The notion that telling patients the truth and giving them a frame of reference that's realistic is actually a therapeutic move that's actually in their best interest, that it's not taking away hope to have people understand the range of things that may happen, are things that we need to imbue into our own medical culture better. And doing so will be enormously challenging. And I have to admit, one of my great concerns, and this, as I said, and I was clear in the piece, the first thing Ruth's doctor did was tell her exactly what was going to happen. So we didn't suffer from this, but I do worry that as we increasingly talk about care of patients who are dying as needing different kinds of specialists and ethics consultations and things like that, those play a role. But the more we subspecialize that intervention, it takes it away from the core activities of the doctor whose primary responsibility is taking care of the patient. And I think that that moves us away from sort of doctor playing the caring, teaching, truth-telling role.
That's Dr. Peter Bach, and let me ask the panel, what do you think of what you just heard?
I think there's a lot of truth to it. What the challenge is honesty with compassion and also having some clinician, probably a doctor, who's going to be a continuous presence in this, in these adventures, because there's a lot of subspecialists involved, but somebody needs to be telling the truth, helping with decision-making all the way through. Honest, being honest but with compassion is really the challenge.
And as the bedside nurse, I would add that the person who is voting for interventions and is occasionally dramatic about that, there are countless ways of saying I love you and infinite ways of expressing denial in the process of getting ready to accept a loss. So you just got to let them be in their process where they are and acknowledge them as you know, being in a process. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to do the intense intervention.
Right. And I think as a palliative care nurse practitioner, all the time we're trying to help make sure that patients and families understand exactly where things are at. And I think we do provide that kind of bridge between the five or six different specialty doctors they're seeing who are all saying a little bit something different, really helping them understand where the story is at and making sure that they understand what the options really are and what the consequences of those choices could be.
Before I get to your phone calls, I wanted to ask Dr. Quill, in preparing for this broadcast, I read some of the work that you've written going back almost 20 years on this subject. Has the landscape changed since you started focusing heavily on end of life and these kind of conversations? Has the landscape changed in terms of what patients are asking and what patients are demanding and people who do or don't have advanced directives? Have things changed in 20 years?
They've changed. There's been some improvements, actually. The presence of palliative care as a field didn't exist 20 years ago. So hospice was just in its infancy. Palliative care was just starting out 10, 15 years ago. Now palliative care is a big part about this. So there is this opportunity to have a real conversation about what's going on. I think we have improved in terms of pain and symptom management. I think we have developed more options for people. I think hospice has expanded. So I think there are more options. We still have a long way to go. And it's very unevenly available, I would say. But I think it's moving in the right direction.
And essentially, do you all agree that when Dr. Bach says it's not taking away hope, if you have to tell a patient, you can try the shunt, for example, that he tried, and it's about 1 in 200, and it can cause terrible side effects and cause emergency surgery and cause instant death and all these things. He's saying to use that blunt language, if you can do it compassionately, that doesn't take away hope. That offers a real perspective because it gives more empowering information about how to die. Do you agree?
It helps patients make a very informed choice, knowing what they're going to agree that they want to go through and for what outcome, what burden versus what benefit.
It's a pretty narrow frame on hope, too. If the only hope comes from like a radical medical intervention, our imagination is pretty limited about hope in that circumstance. So there's all kinds of different things to hope for. And actually, hospice has really taught us a lot about that. That when you kind of let go of the medical interventions, there's spiritual hope, there's healing within families, there's all kinds of reconciliation that might happen. And these things are incredibly meaningful and rich and can be part of, and are often part of this last part of life. But you have to sort of get out from under the medical juggernaut sometimes to get at those things.
And we risk not having a chance to experience that, don't we, if the only form of hope is some sort of a full revival.
Mm-hmm. Right. If you're in the ICU getting the full court press for your last days, the odds of having something like something spiritually rich happen, it can, but it's still a lot harder.
Mm-hmm. Let me take our first call. This is Keith in Ontario. Keith, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Kevin, on your scale of 1 to 5, this is definitely a number 6 show.
Thank you,
really
Keith.
Good show. Sort of like Spinal Tap when they go up to 11. But I'd like to ask the people on your group, and I got some follow-up comments and questions. How many of them have a MOLF agreement, inmates right now.
Hold on, a little definition is probably called for here. What agreement?
So a MOLST
form. Well, the MOLST, medical orders for life-sustaining treatment.
Okay.
Exactly. Many of them have that in place right now.
Okay.
So is the question, do I personally have a MOLST form in place?
Yes.
So I do not have a MOLST form in place. I do have a very clear advanced directive. A MOLST form is something that's done often to outline when people have serious illnesses at this point. But my advanced directive would help direct a MOLST form creation should I need one.
A MOLST form really says what treatments right now you want mm-hmm. and don't want. And so it's for right now. So, again, I don't have a MOLST either, but I have an advanced directive so that if I were to have a cardiac arrest in our program here, I want everything to be tried. But if I come out of that in bad shape, then you go to my advanced directive, and then you would fill out a MOLST based on that. And the directive would be to basically stop everything, and you could fill that in a MOLST. So a MOLST is a directive for right now. It's mostly for seriously ill patients, although you can specify that you would want everything in a MOLST, too. You would want all possible treatments.
Go ahead, Keith.
The one thing, and I speak from this firsthand because I'm a volunteer EMT, and you may have an elderly patient who is, you know, really good, okay, and then all of a sudden they have a massive stroke, and you get on scene, and it becomes, you can imagine what it becomes. All right, and then you get people running around saying, no, don't do that. They don't want that. They don't want that. Well, guess what? We're doing it until you can show us a paper otherwise, or until we get somebody higher up, i.e. a doctor at an ED saying, no, stop it. And I don't think a lot of elderly people, and I know this from my uncle when he was in his 90s, and the only thing he had was a DNR because they think that covers everything, and it doesn't. You could be a healthy 85-year-old today, and your life could change 180 degrees tomorrow due to even in a bad accident or complications from a surgery. And I don't think primary care doctors explain this to the elderly. I've had cases where you have people, you know, sadly in their 80s, are still going to dialysis. And I really, it's sad because you go there for the emergency care and you transport them. And you wonder to yourself, why are they still going through dialysis? And it can be very, not as troublesome, but you sort of wonder, you just go ahead and you do your job. And again, with me, I'm a volunteer, so you go on to the next one.
And so, Keith, the bottom line is more communication with more patients.
More communication, more patients. Give them the honest-to-goodness truth. Don't use the word miracle because it's not going to happen. If you're going to be old and you're going to die, they have to accept the fact. It's just part of life. Death is part of life. And I think most people would want to be in control as to how they die and not leaving it up to other people.
Yeah.
And I don't... Now, again, I'm not faulting these people. I'm just thinking, in general, and I think that's what the president wanted. And then Sarah Palin turned it into death panels and was trying to whack grandma and stuff like that. But on calls, you'd be surprised if people don't have DNR. And then they have the DNR, and usually the first person on scene is law enforcement. They're doing CPR. We get there, blah, blah, blah. You know, where's the DNR? They can't find it.
Okay, well, right? Keith, you've given us – thank you, Keith. You've given us a lot there. And what part of what Keith is bringing up is a question we're going to ask in our next half hour here, which is, you know, the value of an advanced directive – in helping when you have those terrible moments where family may be debating. You may have a spouse and a parent debating. And so we're going to talk about all of that after this short break. Let me ask the panel real briefly here. He spoke very passionately about just general education. Anybody disagree with any of those points?
Not at all.
Yeah. Dr. Quill?
Definitely. Yeah. Definite need for education. Sure.
Let's take the shortest break in radio. We're going to come back. If you don't know what an advanced directive is, I mean, it's pretty easy to understand the term of it, but we already have questions about how do you legally fill it out, et cetera. More of your phone calls coming up, more about advanced directives, and what you ought to know as we think about the fact that, hey, let's all side with Annie Rooney on this. Dying at old age is sad, but it beats dying at a younger age, and the older we get, the more we really should be thinking about all of these possible eventualities. So short break, and more with you next on Member-Supported Public Radio. Coming up in our second hour, we preview the upcoming Latino Film Festival. We'll have film clips and talk to the people who chose the films for Saturday's big event. Then we'll broaden the discussion to ask whether modern media is meeting the needs of Latinos across the country and right here in Western New York. It's all coming up next hour on Connections.
Can I change my health coverage under the Affordable Care Act?
Can I sign up for insurance through the marketplace if my employer's plan is too expensive?
How do I choose a plan for my small business?
WXXI and the Innovation Trail are looking for questions about the Affordable Care Act from people like you. Log on to WXXI.org and take a brief survey about your understanding of new healthcare policies, part of a new WXXI reporting series.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. We have a great panel talking about end-of-life care and decision-making. Dr. Timothy Quills here, the director of the Palliative Care Program at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Laura Hogan is a nurse practitioner. Emily Langfitt, a nurse on Strong's Sussman Palliative Care Inpatient Unit. And so I'm curious to know from our panel, how often have you been in a position where you have an advance directive and the advance directive says, do not do X, Y, Z, and it seems clear, but you have a passionate family member, maybe a spouse or other, who says, don't listen to that. You've got to try everything. Does that happen?
Yes.
It definitely happens.
Yeah, a lot.
A lot.
Yeah. If somebody has really gone to the trouble, about a third of the population has gone to the trouble to fill out an advance directive. So again, two-thirds of the time, there's not an advance directive. But then in that third, is something you fill out when you've got capacity. And it only becomes a relevant document in the future if you lose capacity. So then you have to interpret what does that mean under these circumstances. And it's not a simple process.
I'm reading numbers from a 2003 study, admittedly a little dated, but 64% of doctors have created an advance directive compared to about 20% of the general public at the time. Either way, certainly people in medical institutions have advance directives much more than the average. I took a little survey on the second floor here at WXXI, and we probably fancifully consider ourselves pretty smart people, and there are two of us on this floor with advanced directives on the entire floor. I am not one of them, and that is going to change. But what is the process? How do you create an advanced directive? You want to start, let's start over here. How do you start that process?
It does not need a legal. It's not a legal process. You don't need an attorney. You can get a form either from your doctor's office or online. There is actually a website, doyourownproxy.org, which actually walks you right through the steps. I would recommend when people are doing a proxy that they do talk to their primary care provider about what some of that means, because trying to sort out all the different nuances is important to making sure they understand.
Doyourownproxy.org. Mm-hmm.
If you name somebody to be your healthcare agent, so there's two kinds of advance directives. There's a living will where you say, I would want this, I wouldn't want that if I lose capacity. But if you name somebody, your spouse or a good friend or whoever you think can represent you, you better have a conversation about the kinds of things you want and the kind of things you don't want, because their job is to represent you. It's not to say what they want for you or what they think you would want. It's really they really need to have some information about what you actually want.
And that question about what happens when you have an advance directive and it seems to be clear, but a family member is saying, no, don't listen to that, do it a different way. The main point is the advance directive helps the medical staff understand what the patient wants, not what a spouse or a parent or somebody else wants. That can be very difficult, but that's absolutely vital, isn't it?
Yeah, we have family meetings all the time where we're trying to figure out what mom would want or what dad would want. And if they've done an advance directive, that's huge. We'll have that with us. And if somebody in the family is saying something different, we will be asking them, why do you think what he chose to write down is not what he would really want? And oftentimes it's they don't have any information. They're saying, well, this is what I want for him. And that's not the right question. And that's actually a pretty legally, ethically settled issue, that if we can get good information about what a person would want, that's our marching orders.
As hard as it is to look, say, a spouse in the eye and say, I'm sorry.
Yes. I mean, it's all about trying to do what that if that patient could wake, you know, the Quinlan case, if Karen Ann Quinlan was the first famous right to die case, if the patient could wake up for 15 minutes, understand her circumstances completely, and then had to go back into them, what would she want you to do? And we will often say that we'll sometimes put a chair in the room that's empty as we're having these conversations. What do you think she would say?
You'll actually put an empty chair there.
Sometimes mm-hmm. we do that, yeah. And a lot of times it really helps because people, as they imagine what the patient would want, are able to come together. Well, this is what she had said, and I remember this. And it doesn't always work that way, but it often can.
You're nodding, Laura. You've seen it?
Oh, absolutely. I've met with many families where we have these types of discussions.
Boy, so difficult, but so important. Okay, so how long does it take to create an advance directive? Can be done in how long?
15 minutes.
Right. 15 minutes.
I mean, the process
the paper part.
The paper.
Obviously, the conversations and the decision-making. I mean, those are all conversations to have with a number of people before you decide Or maybe you're someone who wants to only look inward.
Evan, it also warrants saying that you can change them. I mean, if you make and figure out all of your advanced directives today, and next week something changes your perspective, you can change them. It's your document.
That's a hugely important point.
The key part, having the conversation with your family after you've figured out what you want, so make sure they know what you would want. And I will say the key part is also signing it, because there is a little chink of your immortality that goes away. Everybody who signed these things know. I mean, I'm a nut about these things. I think they're really important. But still signing it is not that easy, because you have to acknowledge that you're mortal.
Yep.
And we don't like to do that.
I think we also often see situations where people don't have an advance directive, and the poor family has no idea what the person would say for themselves. And so it's really a gift for someone to fill out this advance directive and have those conversations.
Real briefly here, before we get back to the phones, there are moments where an advance directive is going to be hugely helpful for someone who is maybe our parent, someone who is elderly. Unfortunately, there are moments where someone is younger, and an advance directive may really help family in a very, very difficult time. And Dr. Quill, I know personally you've been there. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, my brother, when he was in his mid-40s, he was a big bicyclist, and he got hit by a car and had a big brain injury. And so we had the phone call from hell, where we had to go to a hospital in Boston and kind of figure out what was going on. He had a severe brain injury, and so we were faced with, what do we do? He's on a ventilator. He's on all kinds of machines. And, you know, we had to imagine what my brother would want, and we did do that. None of us thought he would want further treatment if he wasn't going to recover, and we were told he wasn't going to recover in any way that he would recognize. But he had done an advance directive, and so we were able to look at that document. It said that he would not want these things. And so it does give you a sense of solace that you're making these horrible decisions, very hard decisions, that you're doing what he would have wanted us to do. So again, it's a little bit of a bright light. He was also an organ donor, incidentally. Organ donors are great things to do. The rate of organ donor cards have gone up greatly since we've made it part of license renewal. But again, it's in the midst of these dark situations, these are some bright lights.
When patients ask you, what would you do? Have they asked you? You're nodding right away, Emily.
Sure. Elderly people that you would think, oh my gosh, what do you find to live for when you're, you know, 99 and 3/4 or whatever, and they'll tell you 99 and 7/8. as they have a moment or a day or something when they've revived a bit and on my unit, they want to know, you know, am I going to go forward? Is it going to be all better? Am I getting out of here? And it's usually a last bit of clarity before they pass on my unit. But they do ask often.
Does that change the way you can communicate. If they ask you, don't tell me about the treatment in the range. Tell me what you would do for yourself or for a family member if I was related to you. What does that change for you?
Well, what I try to do in that, I try to think what I would, first of all, I have to think about what would I do. Mm-hmm. So I look inside myself and say, what do I think? I then try to do what I think in light of what I know about their values. So again, it's not about my values, not about my family's values. It's really about their values in light of my medical knowledge. But if they ask me what I think I would do, I tell them. I think people really are in desperate need of guidance about what we really think as medical providers. And mm-hmm. and if they ask us directly, I think we have an obligation to look inside and try to answer that honestly.
Right.
You're nodding, Laura.
Yeah, I think that I have had those situations as well, particularly when people's families are trying to decide if they've made the right decision, sometimes because of lack of an advance directive. And if I feel strongly that that is a decision I would make, I think they're looking for that guidance and reassurance. And I will say something to the effect of, based on what you've told me about your father, this is a decision that makes sense. This is a decision I would make for my father if I was in the same circumstances and he thought this way as well.
Where is your advance directive, Dr. Quill?
My advance directive is in my desk.
Okay.
And my wife's computer.
And your family knows where it is, though.
And my children's computers.
So they know where it is. Okay.
Yes.
Where are your advance directives, Emily?
At my doctor's office, in the safe deposit box, and on the top of my refrigerator.
On the top of your refrigerator as well. Laura?
Truly, I'm probably most delinquent. Mine is in my desk drawer as well. I don't believe my new physician has a copy, but I will rectify that this afternoon.
See, we're all thinking about this. I'm thinking about where I'm going to put mine. Bernard in Fairport. Bernard, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I think this has been a very interesting discussion. I think that one of the concerns that I have is the definition of life. You know, it's easier to define death, but there's a lot of elements about life, and one of those elements that I'm concerned about is control. And one of the concerns that I have about these advanced instructions is that when I'm on my quote-unquote deathbed, the last person I want in the room is a lawyer. So my concern about this whole process is, you know, there is a time when it is better for us to die than to be an experiment for some doctor, even though he might be well-motivated. So my question is, you know, how do we make sure that the system is going to, in fact, meet, if you will, our requests? And that's a major concern about, you know, this whole discussion. My life is defined in my way. I don't really want the medical professionals around me, you know, they should listen to what I say, not listen to what their degrees have taught them. So anyway, thanks very much for the discussion.
Thanks, Bernard. Dr. Quill?
I think the main safeguard would be if you're fortunate enough to have a primary care doctor that you really work well with, to make sure that he or she knows your views and values. If you're in some, if you have a major disease and there's a main treating doctor, a cardiologist or an oncologist, make sure they know your views and values. Because I think if we know a person's views and values, I think that's the best guarantee that it'll be respected, because we really want to do that. I mean, I would say the vast majority of clinicians really see our job as trying to make medicine work within the guidelines of what a person really wants.
Anything to add, Laura, Emily?
No, yeah. That's true.
Okay,
In our electronic medical record, we also have scanned media, so we have people's advance directives when they give them to us, and we can then backtrack and reaccess them. I don't know if that belongs in this.
And to Bernard's note on control, I mean, I appreciate everything Bernard just said. I feel, if I'm ever incapacitated, that the only control I have left is what I would have left behind in a document. Understand it, as opposed to letting someone guess whether it's a lawyer or a family member. But I understand the point there. This is Anna in York. Anna, thanks for calling Connections. Anna, are you there?
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I'm calling because I have had a history of in 2007 I had a brain aneurysm rupture. And survived that, and the past 3 years I've had breast cancer, an aggressive kind, twice. I'm calling because I do think that the the problem with the doctors not really educating people. And, you know, a lot of times people want to know what's going on, but it's also hard to ask. And if a doctor doesn't answer truthfully and give you, you know, the honest answer of what's going on, it sometimes is hard to go after that information.
So I would say, yeah, for better or worse, there are, and as people get sicker and, again, have a number of different conditions like it sounds like you do, there are a number of doctors involved. So it may be that one doctor is not able to communicate in this way, but it is useful to look around to find it might be a primary care doctor, it might be a nurse practitioner in the office, it might be somebody who you feel like you have rapport with who can talk honestly with you. And I do think it's critical to find somebody who can have a more frank conversation and try to formulate your questions and get answers to them.
Does that help, Anna?
I also think that you know, people's mindset to help when they know someone has cancer is you know, okay, you've got to fight, and I think that you know, that's not the case a lot of times, and it's hard when it's hard to explain to people that, well, maybe you aren't going to do, you know, all these different things that are offered, because it's not something that you want to go through. So I think that's really hard too, is the, you know, the pressure of, you know, you're going to fight, and just not, you know, not having that in your own thinking, and to have to deal with that also.
Thanks for the call, Anna. Any other reaction there?
Well, I think it must be hard to feel like you have to defend your decisions about what kinds of treatment you want or don't want.
Yeah. Jenna, Pittsburgh. Jenna, thanks for calling.
My question is, are advanced directive laws different by state? And I have a very personal example of it, which makes me question that. My grandmother has been very clear about her advance directive with every member of our family. There's to be no extraneous measures, no, she has a DNR, but she also has no nutrition, the IV is to be discontinued, no feeding tube, no intubation, et cetera. And she's now 85. She's blind. She has lost her hearing. So she feels very trapped. Or I should say she's hard of hearing. She's not completely deaf. She recently fell and broke her hip, and she had developed a pulmonary embolism, and she made it very clear that it was to be put in place the advance directive, and she was done. And the doctors encouraged my aunt, who has her health proxy and her power of attorney, to override her wishes and to put the feeding tube in and to intubate her and to repair the hip, because this was not her end and she should not be encouraged to end her life. So my question is, are the laws different by state? Because that's, in fact, what happened. They intubated her, they put the feeding tube in, and she's now trapped in a nursing home against her wishes.
Jenna, thanks for the call. Dr. Quill?
So there are differences between states, but that's not the main – I think if people fill out an advance directive, it by and large will cross states. There are some small nuances, sometimes bigger nuances. New York State used to have a kind of not a very good advance directive law. Now we have a good one around issues of feeding tubes. But I think the more difficult situation is that if all it is a guideline for what happens, so then the clinicians and the family have to interpret this and try to figure out what that's trying to say under the circumstances the patient finds himself in. And again, these kinds of circumstances where it sounds like, from what you're saying, the doctor's values were overriding the patient's values, I think this would be a time where, if you think you're in a spot like that, where a palliative care consult or an ethics consult, so that people can step back and say, look, here's what's been happening, here's what the advance directives say, these things don't seem to add up, how should we go forward here? So it is a time to take a fresh look.
Thankfully for our panel, we don't even have time to get into David's email. David was saying he wants to know what they think about not just advanced directives which deal with incapacitation, but ending life with dignity for those who want assisted suicide or euthanasia. David writes to say that why can't we be adults and end extreme suffering with dignity? That's probably a whole other hour, so maybe we'll come back for it. Dr. Quill, can we have you back sometime?
Sure.
Okay. And Laura and Emily, really appreciate your perspective, and thank you very much for taking the time. Laura, one more time, if people want to create their own advanced directive, what's the website you mentioned?
Doyourproxy.org.
Okay. And so a simple Google search is going to find it anyway. And I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. My wife, if you're listening, honey, we're doing it this week. And it's going to get done, and we're going to make sure people know where they have to find it. Our thanks to Dr. Tim Quill, the director of the Palliative Care Program at the University of Rochester Medical Center, Laura Hogan, a nurse practitioner, Emily Langford, a nurse on Strong's Sussman Palliative Care Inpatient Unit. Thanks to all three of you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Short break, and more back with you on Member-Supported Public Radio.